Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. Today, my guest is Lewis Jikstra, who is head of the economic analysis sector in the Directorate General for Regional and Urban Policy at the European Commission. Our subject today is a paper Lewis co-authored with colleagues Hugo Pullman and Andres Rodriguez-Pose called The Geography of EU Discontent. The paper provides the first comprehensive overview of the anti-EU vote across the entire European Union and provides a detailed geographical breakdown. Lewis, welcome to City Talks. We'll put up a link to the paper and the interactive map that you produced, which allows places or people to go in and look at the detail of the work itself. But before we get into the findings and the context, just set the scene and say, what does the paper look at and what the approach is that you adopt in the paper?
Okay, well, thank you. Thanks for having me. The paper really wants to find out what's driving people to vote for parties that are against the EU. There's been a lot of research on personal characteristics, where people are on low income, unemployed, but we also wanted to look at the spatial characteristics. What types of area generate a lot of discontent about the EU? So the ambition was to go down to a very fine scale, where you can start looking at things like, do people live in a town? Do people live in a city? Is it a rural area? And also the impact of local economic changes. Is there a reduction in employment? If so, what kind of employment? What about income? Has that changed over time? And so that was our main driving force, to really understand what places in the EU feel very unhappy with the work we're doing.
And it covers all of the European Union countries. And you look at the voting data, you just say what the data set is for the votes.
We look at all 28 current member states, yes. Including the UK.
Included.
We look at the votes in the most recent national elections. Most of them are somewhere between 2015 and 2018. And we look at the distribution of the votes by party. Mm-hmm. And then there's another group, Chapel Hill Expert Survey, who assesses all those parties whether they are strongly in favor or strongly opposed to EU integration. And so we wanted to get down to a fine level of detail, so we were able to get the data for 63,000 voting constituencies, so really small places that allows you to look at the character of the place and how that influenced those votes.
Okay, so let's start off with, so you look at, first of all, and the way the paper is structured, you look at the disenchantment or otherwise and the growing in disenchantment with the European Union. So just set the scene, tell us about what those findings were in the first instance.
Well, looking at votes, some people would argue, well, you know, parties have a multitude of opinions, positions in their program, and they may not be motivated to vote for that party just because that party happens to be against EU integration. So the first thing we wanted to check, is there a change in the way people look at the EU? Mm-hmm. Is there a reduction in the level of trust? Do more people say, ooh, I'm not sure about this EU thing? So we have a Eurobarometer that's conducted every year, twice a year. We interview about 1,000 people in every country. So we've looked at that since 2004, and we've seen really radical increases in the number of people who say that they don't tend to trust the EU. So clearly, there is a general change in the perception of governments, including the EU governments. The same increase in distrust can also be seen of national governments. But other than, you know, Catalonia or Scotland, there aren't too many regions trying to leave their country.
No.
Whereas leaving the EU for many political parties is something they actively endorse.
Yeah. So there is a story that, and it's a reflective of a broader trend you just alluded to, which is a disenfranchisement with politics and politicians. And obviously, the European Union is caught up in a lot of that. Is that fair?
Absolutely. I think it is part of a broader trend, but I think the EU is very atypical. People still struggle to really understand what it exactly does, why it's there, how it operates. And to be honest, we haven't made it super easy to understand either, so I have some sympathy for that difficulty. But as a result, I think we're now facing bigger challenges to the union, questioning our functioning, questioning the membership of that union. Yeah. And Brexit is an obvious example of that.
Yeah, one of the few upsides of the Brexit process and conversation is that I think many more people in the UK know much more about the European Union than they did 2 years ago. Probably should have known it 3 years ago, but that's slightly different. So when you look at the barometer over time, which do we see, you know, noticeable trends in some countries much more becoming much more anti-EU than others?
I mean, the overall trend seems to be a significant increase. Most countries really saw a big increase in the numbers. You know, there were 10 percentage points, 20 percentage points up. The crisis also has played a role in there. I mean, Greece, for example, is a country where you see a big increase in the distrust, both in national and in the EU. And of course, given the very difficult financial situation and the impact of the crisis, you know, those things have to be linked to interpret that. But we see a general rise over time. Only very few countries actually reduced the amount of distrust in the union. And so this is obviously a big source of concern for us, especially in light of the upcoming European elections. Mm.
And for our UK listeners, when you look at that data, the UK isn't the most anti-EU country, is that right?
That's correct. If I looked at prior to the Brexit referendum, if I looked either at the votes for parties that were strongly against EU integration or the level of distrust, the UK doesn't stand out.
No.
It is fairly average inside the union. There is some distrust. You've got the UKIP vote, but there wasn't a really strong electoral or perceptions of the audience that the EU is a bad thing and we needed to leave.
Yeah. And when you look at the relationship, which you do in the paper, between the share of votes for parties that are, you know, strongly opposed or moderately opposed to the EU EU integration and that trust element, what's the kind of relationship? What do we see?
It's very heterogeneous. I mean, some countries are extremely consistent, high levels of distrust, high votes for parties against the EU integration. You can say, you know, the Greece is a good example of that. But then you also have countries with a high vote against EU integration, but a high level of trust, like Denmark. So
yeah,
that's kind of surprising. And then some countries actually, very few parties actually oppose EU integration, notably in Spain or Cyprus or Slovenia. But nevertheless, the trust level isn't so high.
Yeah.
So there, you wonder what's going to happen. I, of course, working for the EU, I would hope that trust goes up.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, recent elections, regional elections in Spain also show it can go the other way. There is, you know, some parties who say, well, there's an opportunity here to represent some of that distrust, and now there is a quite vocal party that is against the EU integration.
Yeah, because do you think that's what it is, in a sense that in Spain, because we'll come on to this, because you also look at the relationship between anti-EU and populism more generally, but mm-hmm. you know, in places like Spain, there isn't really a party that's anti-EU, so it doesn't pick up those votes. Is that part of the explanation, or do people just vent their frustration, but actually then, you know, when it comes to the vote, they go in a different direction?
It's we analyze places, so
yeah,
we have data for 250 million votes, but we don't have the individual motivations of 250 million voters. So it's difficult to know what is their primary objective, what is their primary motivation. Parties represent a cluster of values, and of course parties, their main goal is to maximize their votes. So sometimes they'll be a little bit studied, ambiguous on certain points. So it's not always easy to pin down what the party really wants or why people truly vote for those parties. I do think the crisis has had an impact. It has shaken up a lot of the trust that people had in institutions, including the EU. Hopefully now, with the crisis mostly behind us, we'll see a decline in that.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I do think we need to make sure that people fully grasp the benefits of the union in a way that currently a lot of countries, you know, don't yet.
Yeah. And in the paper, you go on to look at the relationship between votes against, I suppose, European integration and a more general sort of definition around populism and populist parties. And you draw some conclusions. Just say a little bit about that. How do you differentiate those when we're thinking about more populist parties or more populist positions and an anti-EU position?
So the paper draws on a lot of research on why people vote for populist parties. There's a lot of research in the European context, but also in the North American context. And so we wanted to draw on that research to see what people, what type of places and what type of people are more likely to vote for these parties. But the nuance is, you know, some parties definitely use a very clear characteristic of a populist party. They are against the elite, they're against the establishment. So that's how we try and characterize the parties, again, using this Chapel Hill expert survey. But some parties are very clearly populist and very strongly against EU integration. But there's quite a bit of variation there. It's definitely not a one-on-one match. Podemos, for example, in that ranking scores quite high on, say, the use of anti-elite and establishment rhetoric, but they're actually categorized as somewhat in favor of EU integration. The UK Conservatives, definitely not characterized as a populist party, are considered somewhat against EU integration. So it really, you see a mixed bag. But there's definitely a significant overlap.
Yeah, and in this, do you see a similar pattern in terms of, you know, the rise of populism across the European Union in the same sort of way that we've seen a more general rise around anti-EU? Is that the similar pattern, or is there something more going on?
No, that's something we were unable to address with the data we have. I know that The Guardian has done a nice work on votes for populist parties. The difficulty we had is this Chapel Hill expert survey only provides an assessment of populist rhetoric one point in time, so we couldn't go back in time. The Guardian has worked with Kosmode and created a time series which clearly shows, also in Europe, a significant increase in the share of votes for parties that are considered populist.
Yeah. And when you look at the geography of those that sort of patterns, what are we looking at in terms of within countries? I suppose you draw out some of the differences around rural and small towns and cities and bigger towns. Just say a little bit about the geography of those sort of things we see across the different countries.
Okay. So we've looked at two levels of opposition. So we first looked at the votes that were opposed or strongly opposed. Say this is roughly 13% of the votes. And we've also looked at the votes which include the parties which are somewhat opposed. Now, if you include somewhat opposed, then you get up to like 26%. So that really doubles the vote share. And you get a lot of parties which are fairly mainstream. So I prefer focusing on the opposed and strongly opposed. And if you look at that dimension, there's a clear urban-rural split. Larger cities, denser towns, typically have a lower share of anti-EU votes. The more rural end of the spectrum definitely shows higher level of discontent, i.e., higher vote share for parties opposed to EU integration. A couple other indicators that pop out clearly, some of them are as expected. You'd expect places with a lower share of tertiary educated to be more prone to vote against EU integration. We find that too. Low employment rates, we find that as well. Economic decline, industrial decline, we confirm that. The odd one out is GDP per head. We found that places with a relatively higher GDP per head tend to also vote more against EU integration. The kind of interpretation I give to that is that this is relative decline. These were places that used to be better off, used to have well-paying industrial jobs, lost those jobs, lost that income. It might be replaced with some other job, but not the kind of secure, high-paying jobs they were used to.
Yeah.
And so relative to the rest of the country, they see in themselves sliding backwards without much hope that it's going to improve. And as a result, that generates a lot of concern, resentment, and that expresses itself politically as well.
Yeah, because I think we'll come into that in a bit more detail, because that's when you in the paper you know you go through some of the existing analysis that's been done, which typically focus on individual characteristics and identifies things like age or education or income to varying degrees, and the extent to which places or not have experienced kind of migration, rurality. So there's a, what are your thoughts around those sorts of explanations? And then we'll come on to, I think, you know, the real powerful bit, which is the relative position, I think, is a really strong element to the analysis.
Well, we looked at the impact of age. So we looked at the impact of the share population over 65. We didn't find a very strong impact, and we didn't find a very consistent impact. So, for example, for parties strongly opposed, having more people over 65 reduces the number of votes for those parties. It also reduces the number of votes for all the parties somewhat opposed and strongly opposed. Only for strongly plus opposed did we find a positive relationship with the age of the population over 65. So clearly there we find a quite ambivalent relationship and a not very strong one. The same is true for net migration. Now, net migration sounds like it's something that you measure, you know, the number of people coming into a country. But if you measure it at the regional level, like we do at the NUTS 3 level, so small regions, it incorporates also movements within the country.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a good indicator that captures whether a lot of people came to that region from another country inside the EU or a different country from outside the EU. So this is something we're still wanting to look at, and we're trying to get very detailed data so we can match our 63,000 constituencies with population data for that.
Yeah.
We also want to look in more detail at the age composition. You know, is it really the retirees, or is it people like myself, middle-aged and up, or is it the young? You know, which age group really has a big impact on that vote share? And then one thing that we haven't considered so far, but we're hoping to look at as well, is the turnout.
Right.
You know, what does it matter how many people decided that they wanted to vote in that national election?
And just say a little bit about the methodology that you've approached, because you're looking at, you know, you're looking at a bunch of variables, you're doing some regression to trying to decompose those variables and isolate. So just say something a little bit about the method that you you adopted, and then when you do the when you've applied that method, how that falls out into the findings that you find.
So what we try to do is we take as an independent variable, we try and predict basically how many people will vote for a party that's against EU integration. And then we take as the dependent variable. As an independent ones, we take a whole bunch of characteristics of that place. So we've really tried many different things in there. And the ones that really are significant are level of economic development, so GDP per head, economic growth, employment rate, education, density, and to some extent age. So those are really the key ones. We looked at a couple other ones which were kind of curious. We looked at the distance to the national capital. There we get a little bit variable results. You know, maybe people close to the national capital feel better represented by their national government, and maybe therefore a little bit more skeptical of the EU. We also thought maybe people close to another country may realize that, well, you know, it's kind of useful to be able to cross that border. So we're also going to look at the distance to a national land border. In the case of the UK, you know, it would only be the border on the island of Ireland. But in many countries in Europe, there are many people living close to a national border. So that's another aspect we want to investigate. But yeah, the key, what boosts votes against EU integration, it's clearly low growth, industrial decline, low density, low employment, low education, and a higher share of the over 65. Those are the main drivers that we found.
Yeah. And does that, and that finding applies obviously at the aggregate across the country? Yeah. Do we see much variation, heterogeneity within?
We've used a country dummy, so we look at the changes within the country. There are some countries where we don't find much diversity. If you look at some of the map, you'll see that, you know, in some countries like Romania or Croatia, there is just a uniform position that all the countries are either neutral or favoring EU integration. I forget who said it, but there was a description of countries in the EU as there's two types of countries in the EU: countries that are small and countries that don't realize they're small yet.
Is there anything around newer and older? You know, in a sense that some of the newer countries that have joined the European Union more or relatively more recently, there's mm-hmm. a different pattern there to those that I suppose that have been in it and around it for a very long time.
I do think we see generally lower levels of opposition in the countries that joined in 2004 and 2007, the Eastern countries. They obviously also still benefit substantially from cohesion policy, so they see their infrastructure improving. But unfortunately, a legacy of a lot of support or even continued support doesn't necessarily lead to higher support for the union. I mean, Greece has been the beneficiary yeah. of cohesion policy for extensive periods of time, as has Italy, as has Wales and Cornwall, for yeah. example. So I don't think it's a panacea, but we want to look into more closely whether our funding and our support for the least developed regions has had a tempering effect on this tendency. Yeah. So this is something Andres and I will be looking into for another paper. Right now, it's too early to know, but it's definitely a question first in our mind.
It's a fantastic paper. It raises loads of interesting kind of reflections and questions. I mean, the two put just get you to expand on, you know, this notion that a key factor is the relative position of that place, and often relative to itself at a period in the past. If, you know, in the sense that people, places feel that they are, you know, less wealthy or less prosperous or less optimistic than they were at some point compared to themselves in the past, is a real issue. And within that, because, you know, you and I are also interested in how we resolve and deal with those sorts of questions on an economic development perspective, it's that kind of classic middle income kind of gap or problem where it's not the very poorest necessarily. It's obviously, you know, it tends not to be the, you know, the richer places as well. It's that middle income group, which, as we know, is often the most difficult type of place to help relatively improve its position, right? But just say a little bit more about, you know, the relativity and the, you know, the position and, you know, your reflections on that.
Well, this is definitely one area of big concern for us. I'm the editor of the regional working papers, and we put out a working paper looking in particular at the middle income trap as a risk for particular regions in Europe, and we're following up with a larger study on that. And indeed, we see, in principle, the poorest regions do manage to catch up, improve their incomes, improve their standards of living. But at a certain point, it really requires a big transition in the type of economic development that you aspire to or that you want to foster. And typically, we see that this can cause breaks in the development. Development is not really linear. You know, there are qualitative jumps that you have to make at a certain point, and it requires you to get a lot of things right at the same time. And so we do see, especially regions that have lost a lot of employment in industry, especially if that was a large employer, that they face quite a bit of difficulties to try and regenerate that economic activity, create more jobs, either in different sectors and often in different firms. And so this is an area for concern. With cohesion policy, we made one change. It might be subtle, but it was definitely inspired by this concern. We have enlarged the eligibility for the middle category. Okay. So we currently have transition regions, which were between 75% and 90% of GDP per head. We've enlarged that to 100% of GDP, so from 75 to 100. So we've got more regions in that group to try and help them, you know, break through that glass ceiling and then really become a much more productive and much more innovative economy, allowing them to catch up with the forerunners, with the more innovative places in Europe. So that was inspired by that, but we really need to think very carefully about what are the best ways to help these places. A big difficulty is that once you move from a situation where your economy is dependent on a very large industrial employer, if you want to, and that employer stops, you know, goes bust or downsizes, then you need to start thinking about an economy where you generate and create a lot more firms, a lot more entrepreneurial activity. And this is something that the workforce is maybe not prepared for, but maybe also the access to credit is not prepared for, the links with academia and research aren't ready for that. So it really requires a group of things to change at the same time to make that transition. And you also have to convince people who have been used to, you know, a fairly stable, reliable financial situation to take that risk and say, no, I'm going to take that jump. I'm going to start my own company. And that's really what you need to kind of kickstart and turn these places around. But how do you help that succeed is a big question for regional, national, and obviously also for the EU.
Yeah, I mean, and I just... you kind of started to allude in there, and it picks up on, you know, other work that you've been involved with, and actually a previous guest on City Talks was Andreas, you know, who was talking about a place-based, you know, place-sensitive mm-hmm. development policies, which tries to identify the clubs, crudely, the development clubs that different places are in, mm-hmm. which is partly a reflection on their, you know, income levels and other indicators, and then trying to think about, you know, policy-led responses to those different sorts of clubs, very much not exclusively, but, you know, trying to inform European policy, European regional and cohesion policy. But just say a little bit more about, you know, how that's evolving, you know, what we've learned from the past, what we might do. You know, what we might do differently, you know, as we go through into the next decade or so?
Well, there's a couple of things where we really want to shift the focus a little bit. One of the traditional methods of trying to, you know, reignite economic growth in less developed regions or middle income regions has traditionally been infrastructure investment. It's a classic approach, but most economists would argue that there's a decreasing return zone to investment in that particular field. So if you already have a quite high level of accessibility, if you're not particularly congested, you know, spending more on transport infrastructure is not going to make much of a difference to your region or your city. And so we really want to encourage regions to think very carefully, is this the true bottleneck to growth? We think things more like improving the business environment could be a very important aspect. So we're now studying ease of doing business in regions and cities across the EU together with the World Bank. We're doing a regional enterprise survey asking CEOs and managers of small firms, okay, what are the biggest obstacles for you to overcome and to achieve higher growth? It could be access to credit, it could be access to markets, it could be, you know, red tape, bureaucracy. And so we're really keen to understand what are the obstacles there. And so a big chunk of cohesion policy can be used to improve the business environment. And I think that's really key to make sure that businesses can focus on their core task, which is not, you know, applying for licenses and permits and paying taxes, but it's, you know, selling their services, selling their goods on the European single market. So that's another key element. And then the last thing, it's really trying to improve that connection between academics, research, innovation, and entrepreneurship. If we really make sure that those connections are strong, I think we will see more firms being created and them growing faster and generating more wealth, more income, and more jobs.
Yeah,
as well.
And it's as you say, it's a fascinating sort of, it's always the balance between, you know, the kind of classic, you know, vertical type policies and then horizontal policies or place blind policies and place, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. place specific policy, trying to find, you know, the right balance between those sorts of things. And I think, I mean, get your thought on it, because you touched on this with the infrastructure. I don't think we, in general, we don't think enough about the sequencing of interventions. And yes, we, mm-hmm. you know, ideally mm-hmm. we want to be doing all things, you know, mm-hmm. you know, roughly at the same sort of time. But, you know, thinking more carefully about the sequencing of different types of interventions, whether they're essentially working on the supply side or on the demand side, I think mm-hmm. we've just, I don't know what your thoughts are. I think we've got more to do in that sort of space. You know, we just fall into that, you know, easy to respond. If we just had more transport infrastructure, or if we have better roads, you know, and we hear this in the UK currently, right? It's not, you know, I know it's happening in other countries as well. You know, the big problem, you know, holding back certain parts of our countries, you know, is transport infrastructure, and it's probably, you know, isn't very good relative to other places. I remain unconvinced. It's the, you know, it's the kind of number one fact. It might be,
yeah.
you know, if we get success in other forms, we might get it. But
I see the temptation. I mean, obviously, physical investments are very visible. They offer ribbon-cutting opportunities, and people understand the benefit it gives to their lives and to companies. So, and having said that, there are definitely still places in Europe where the physical infrastructure is in such poor condition that more investments are totally legitimate. But nevertheless, I do think we need to think very carefully about, if we invest in that, it basically means we open up the local market to more competition. Mm. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the local firms are going to win that competition. Yep. So the key thing for me really is that if you want to allow more market penetration in a particular area, you need to accompany it with actions that allow those firms to compete. And really, this goes back to the origins of cohesion policy. We were created at the same time as the single market, and there was a real concern that the less competitive, the less productive regions were going to lose out to the more productive firms in the capital regions. Now, this hasn't always been the case. Sometimes regions were very adept at taking advantage of their particular strengths and really been able to grow, but it is a genuine risk. And so I do think anytime you're going to change the access to the market and foreign markets, you also need actions to improve the strength and the productivity of the local firms. So you need something more on skill set. And also, I think the digital economy is going to continue to disrupt a lot of actors. And so being able to take advantage of that, having the right connections, having the right skill sets, and being able also to take advantage of the opportunities offered by the digital economy are really key to make sure that opening up your region doesn't mean that your firms lose out.
Yeah. And I was talking to Andreas about this, get your thoughts. And there's often been there still is, I suppose, a tension in some minds, at least between, you know, this trade-off between equity and inefficiency. You know, if we're helping the left behind or low-income or middle-income places, then essentially that's an equity argument and it's an inclusion argument. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, we might get better inclusion outcomes, but we run the risk of lower aggregate outcomes in growth. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you're doing the talking. So just give me your thoughts on that. And, just try to bring listeners up to speed as to where we are with those sorts of, fairly, I think, sterile kind of conversations, really.
Yeah, I think we do get criticized out, say, from academics and politicians who believe that investing more in the most productive places will generate more aggregate growth. And because a lot of defenders of policy aren't so focused on the efficiency argument, they emphasize the solidarity and the equity argument. But in actual fact, if you speak to a lot of economists, and this includes our DG for Economics and Finance, ECFIN, their models suggest that what we are doing increases aggregate growth. And in effect, the contributions to the union flow from richer places to poorer places, so we help them catch up, help them improve their productivity, and actually we believe that this increases aggregate output. So I find the mantra that you need to spend more in the places that already have a lot of money not very convincing. And in terms of being able to generate more growth, I also don't find that very convincing. In particular, what I'm concerned about is that if you have a country which is highly dependent on the performance of a single place, typically the capital region, you are much more exposed. You might risk having much more booms and busts. And I think for a company, if you want to have the optimal location, the best location, the trade-off between cost, accessibility, quality of the labor force, if you just have two options, which is high quality, high cost, or low cost, low quality, you might not find the best spot for you. So I'm a firm believer that actually every country needs a variety of combinations of costs and quality to allow that firm to find its own optimum. And for me there, the performance and the position of the second tier cities is really critical.
Yeah.
So if you really see only the capital being very performant and all the other cities actually underperforming, you can't explain that with urban economics. Something else is going on there, and I don't think that something else is efficient. I think it actually makes your country less attractive for investors and firms.
And your work, I think Andre's work in his, you know, the revenge of the places left behind, and indeed people like Mike Stauper's, mm-hmm. you know, work in some shows the political and social externalities that are generated by quite, you know, in unequal forms of development, which you then get, you know, you get the responses through the, not necessarily through economics directly, but you certainly get it through politics, which I think is a kind of, an interesting insight that we need to grapple more with, I think.
Yeah, one other element there, which I find delicate, is that different changes generate different costs and benefits at different levels of government. And, you know, UK government has done several studies on migration, for example, and it's very clear that the people who come here to work in the UK pay far more taxes than they use in terms of services. So it's a net benefit to the UK, but it's a net benefit to the central government. And it may take time for those benefits to get transferred to the local authorities who need to provide those services, nevertheless, already today. So the impression at the local level is, well, this is generating a lot of additional costs, where the impression at the central level is, well, this is generating a lot of benefits. And I think that discrepancy and that lag for those benefits at the central level to be shared with the local authorities is also one of the things that is boosting this discontent and this frustration. And of course, a situation where you see a lot of austerity, reduction in staff and services at the local level will only contribute to that.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. Cause one of the things that has always struck me, but particularly, I suppose, over the last couple of years, you know, when you're up and down the country in different places talking about, you know, why we see the reactions that we do, there's definitely a sense that people are and places are disappointed or frustrated with, you know, some of the content of policy. You know, why is it focusing on this when actually it should be focusing on that? But there's definitely a kind of a frustration and a disenfranchisement from, you know, the model of policy making, as in who's making those decisions and the means by which those decisions then get translated and, you know, that can be held accountable. And I mean, it's partly a reflection on, I guess, the relatively strongly centralized nature of the UK, but I think it's a broader story about who makes the decisions that influence the lives of people in localities and how we can, you know, better match that. Do you think
that is a tension that's present in many countries? Yeah. You know, the role of local government is always quite heavily debated. You have countries where they have a very strong role, other countries where they have a lesser role. But of course, often their role is constrained by the central government. They depend primarily on transfers for some of their income. And so it's difficult in the sense that the local level is often the level where you can encourage participation the most easily, but often their hands are quite tied in what they can do. In political science, you've got the classic term of the unfunded mandate, where central governments decide that they'll push through a spending cut and they'll give the responsibility to the local government at the same time, trying to say, oh, but the local government will be so much more efficient than the central government, they'll be able to reach the same results with far less money.
Yeah.
That is often a little optimistic, and it's prone to frustration.
Yeah, no.
Well, it's a high-risk strategy.
Yeah, we've just published our annual Cities Outlook, and this year, you know, we looked at, 10 years of, you know, local government or locality reductions in expenditure. And, you know, you see some quite eye-watering, results that come from that. But for certain, you know, there's been somewhat unfairly, but nevertheless, places they've been rewarded by their success by having more cuts. Right? You know, you seem to be doing quite well. We've taken, 50% out of your budget. You know, nothing's fallen over. You know, here's another 25%. That's not a good way to go. You know, I think, you know, we want to encourage efficiency and effectiveness, but there are limits to it. From the what's been the reaction to the paper, Lewis, in terms of internally within the commission, and then, you know, a more generally amongst the, you know, the policy community that you interact with?
I do many things in my day job, and I work on lots of different topics. In all honesty, this was one of the smaller projects I was working on. We have a lot of other topics we deal with. But this one, since we published it late December, I mean, to the extent that anything that a commission publishes goes viral, this one went viral.
No, I think this one went viral. I mean, there's an awful lot of interest, definitely.
Yeah. No, we have been contacted by national media in multiple countries. We've been asked for many, many different presentations. Andres has been traveling throughout Europe to talk about the places that don't matter, but also the geography of EU discontent. I've already given 5 presentations. I'm giving another 5 presentations on the topic. So the outpouring of interest has been massive. Mm. I mean, part of this is linked to, it's very timely. We've got a European election coming up. A lot of people are concerned about that. We have a new commission coming up who needs to identify their priorities and their agenda. So I think this came at a time where a lot of people wanted to have some reflection about, are we seeing a big increase in discontent with the union, distrust of the union? How can we address this, and what are the drivers behind it? I love that this paper was being able to zoom in on the characteristics of places, because you know, just saying, oh, just wait till the old people aren't there anymore, and then everybody will love the EU, is a bit of a fatalistic approach, and not one that I would recommend. I would much rather focus on changing hearts and minds today, and making sure that as people grow older, they maintain a support and an interest for the union, as we see in the younger generation, who is more mobile and understands the benefit of visa-free travel and of being able to use your mobile phone without roaming costs. There are tangential benefits that people understand, but it's important to keep those forefront in people's minds when they go to the voting booth.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I are obviously biased, but do you think then the significance and the salience of regional policy, you know, thinking becomes more important in for the European Union over time, in part about, you know, just a response mechanism to, you know, to these sorts of, these kind of trends that we, you know, that we observe? Because as you say, you know, this is not just a snapshot, it's a trend which is long-standing, certainly predates, you know, the crisis that we saw in 2008, and certainly, you know, more recent kind of political responses. So, you know, it's a longer run trend, and one of the ways we try and deal with it, understand it, but also more particularly deal with it, is this kind of variated response at locality and, you know, at regional level. So does that give us a sense that this becomes more important? We're optimists, right?
Well,
we're biased.
I'm professionally biased and proud to be so. I work for the EU because I fully support that organization. We're in the middle of the discussion about the next budget, which we assume will cover only 27 countries. Yep. In that budget, we definitely propose to continue to invest strongly in reductions of disparities and in helping rural areas. So I think all the elements are there to definitely continue to address some of these issues. But I think it also raises questions about how we do that, how can we make sure that our spending has a bigger impact, but also how do we communicate that to people? How do people understand that some of the things which have changed for the better in their area has been in part because we've provided that support. Right now, we see fairly low levels of awareness, even in regions where we invest quite considerably. So I think it encourages us to have a good think about how do we manage to convey the benefits being part of the union confers on your country, on your region, on your city. So there, I think there's some more thinking to do on our side. How do we reach out to a broader community about what we do?
My guest today has been Lewis Jikstra. Lewis, thanks for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre4Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.